This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Philosophy Bites is unfunded. Please help us keep it going by subscribing or donating at www.philosophybites.com, or you can become a patron at Patreon.
I'm reading this cue from my laptop because, even if I'd thought about what I wanted to say, I'm useless at remembering a sequence of sentences. I'm entirely dependent on my laptop for this sort of job, and for many others. I can't rely on my mind alone. But according to Andy Clark, my laptop may be regarded as an extension of my mind.
Andy Clark, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hi, it's great to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is the extended mind. What do you mean by the extended mind?
Okay, so the extended mind was the title of a paper that Dave Chalmers and I wrote back in 1998. And the idea in that paper was that the human mind, or indeed perhaps minds in general, don't have to end at the limits of skin and skull. So the thought was that perhaps our mind can sometimes include bio-external structures and events.
Well, that's really intriguing. What is a bio-external structure?
Yeah, so that makes it sound pretty fancy, but all that we had in mind in that paper really was very familiar things, like perhaps the use of a pen, paper, a notebook. That paper, the extended mind paper, revolved around a particular thought experiment that involved two people, Inga and Otto. Inga was a bio-normal agent. Her name, Inga, was meant to have the word in it, so she's a kind of inside agent. The other agent is Otto. Name's got kind of out in it, so the outside agent. And Otto has mild Alzheimer's, relies on a notebook into which he always writes new pieces of information about addresses and important things like that. They both want to go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and Inga just remembers where it is, and she goes. Otto automatically whips out his notebook, sees the address, and goes there. And Dave and I argued that, in fact, both of them know in advance what the address of the Museum of Modern Art is, and they rely on that knowledge to get there. So we want to treat the two cases as being on a par mentally, rather than actually thinking that all that Otto knows is, as it were, that the information is in his notebook.
So I've got lots of people's email addresses and phone numbers on my phone. I remember some of them, not all of them. Are you suggesting that my mind has extended into my phone? Or are you saying that that's just a little tool that I use to enhance my mind?
Yep, we really are making the more radical claim here. In the case where you have over a period of time come to form a sort of larger system, well, let's say it's your iPhone, so it's normally available when you want to solve a certain kind of problem, you automatically start to pull it out and access the information in that sort of way. We want to argue that that's just the same as pulling out the information from your biomemory. And so in each case, you don't have to go through an additional thought process, which is something like, oh, I think perhaps this information is stored in biomemory, let me get it. Or, I think perhaps this information is stored in my iPhone, let me get it. It's not supposed to be like that. It's supposed to be a much more overlearned, automatic process where this is just how a system like you solves this kind of problem.
So I would solve the problem of getting to MoMA by getting on a subway and relying on information coded in that system to take me to the correct stop, 53rd Street, I think, or somewhere around there. And that will then outsource that information for me. Are you saying that the subway system is part of my mind when I'm in New York?
Good, that's a lovely question. And actually, interestingly, one of the predecessors of the extended mind story was a famous paper by John Hoagland called Mind Embodied and Embedded. And in that paper, Hoagland argued that, for example, if his horse knew the way somewhere and he jumped on his horse and the horse went there, then in a way there was a sort of extended system that knew the way. So Chalmers and I did argue, and I still believe, that there are important differences here. And the differences are fairly intuitive. They have to do with portability, availability of this kind of solution whenever you want it. So the trouble with the subway solution is it's very dependent on you being in a particular spatial location so you can get into the subway. Or the horse one is very dependent on the horse being there. Whereas in the case of your iPhone, most of us really do, most of the time now, have our smartphone with us. And so there's this difference in robust availability. Is this strategy available as and when you need it most of the time?
But once you've broken the preconception that your skin is the barrier for yourself somehow, that your mind can extend into the world, why would you put an emphasis on portability? Because I could keep my diary a long way away from me. It could be huge, but I can still consult it.
Yeah, portability isn't quite the right notion. The notion of availability as and when required is the right notion. So portability, or having stuff actually locked inside your bio head, these are good ways of ensuring that stuff is available when you want it. They're not foolproof. You know, you might have had too much to drink the night before and your bio memory is not doing what it should. But as long as stuff is mostly available as and when it's needed, then it's a good candidate for getting woven into the overall set of knowledge, if you like, that we think should count as you.
When I forget a name of a film star or a philosopher or something like that, I check on the internet. I go to Google, basically. And I'm worried that, on your account, all the information out there that I could potentially source is part of my mind, because anything I could search for is available to me.
If we became fluent enough at doing that search and were able to integrate the information that came back well enough with other information, then we would want to count that. But in general, of course, we're not as fluent at that for doing the search. When we get the information back, we are not fluent at integrating it with what we already know. And so I think that in practice, it's a very hiccupy sort of process at the moment. But as it becomes more and more fluid, and it could be made more fluid by outsourcing even more than we currently do. So you could actually outsource a lot of the sort of search process itself. Maybe you could even begin to outsource how information from the search gets integrated with what you already know, because perhaps now it gets presented in a particular kind of format that makes it easier to merge it with what you already know. The more of that that goes on, the more I think we should start to count this stuff as stuff that in some way you already know, because the underlying thought here, I think, is that knowledge is access. And so, you know, I would say that you right now know what month this is. But that's not because you're kind of consciously rehearsing what month it is. Rather, it's because you can retrieve that information just like that with high confidence, high reliability. That ability to retrieve, I think, is what counts.
Now, this is quite a radical thesis, isn't it? Because you're suggesting that thousands of years of history where that mind has been thought of as enclosed in the skull or somehow caught up in the soul, which is enclosed in the body, that's all wrong. Actually, all that time throughout history, people have been outsourcing information and their minds have extended far beyond the confines of their skin.
Yes, I think that's right. I suppose that in a way, if there was a sort of illusion or mistake here, it was maybe tied up with the early waves of materialism and physicalism. You know, when it became clear that the brain was really important, I think simultaneously we started to think that maybe the brain was all there was. But I don't think that was ever true to lived human experience. So surely throughout history, we've had the feeling that somehow we know more when we're in some situations and contexts than others, when we're interacting with the right people. I think there is a genuine human sense of not being bounded exactly by what your biological brain could do in a vacuum.
Now, this might just seem like a philosophical quibble about whether we choose to describe the mind in one way or another. These are just two different ways of looking at the same thing. We could describe forgetting something and retrieving it from a diary purely in those terms, or you could say, actually, I'm accessing another part of my mind. It doesn't really matter. Is that accurate? Does it matter?
I think it does matter. There are two ways, I think, to get at the matter in. One is a sort of more philosophical way, and the other is maybe a more moral or ethical way. So the philosophical way is to think that when we assess something as either being part of our mind or not, we shouldn't prejudice the way that we make that assessment by thinking about the location of the process. So a key move in the original Chalmers-Clark paper was to suggest what we called a principle of parity. And the idea was that you should think about the way that this process is manipulating information to solve a problem, and then ask yourself, suppose that manipulation was done in the head, how would you then feel about it? So you could imagine creatures, you know, I called them the bitsies in one paper, and the bitsies were able to do in their head just the kind of stuff that we do using pen and paper. They could store bitmapped images that they could then retrieve later and get more information back by looking, as it were, at their own bitmapped images. And surely, if there were alien creatures that operated like that, we'd say, well, the Bitsis are a little bit different to us, but it's all their cognition. That's how they think. That's how their minds work. And just because we do it using pen and paper, reading stuff in by eyes and hands, why should that make a difference? So that's a philosophical way.
But that philosophical way doesn't really answer my question about does it matter there, because it doesn't really matter whether we describe the Bitsis as thinking using external stuff or as having minds which extend beyond their bodies.
Yeah, that's right. So that's when we can be perhaps moved more strongly by ethical considerations. In particular, there's a philosophical argument here by Rob Rupert that says everything that Clark and Chalmers and people like that say about the extended mind, you can say without being radical. Just let's think about the embedded mind, the productively embedded in body and world mind. And that's fine as far as it goes, but I think that that gives us the wrong result with regard to certain real-world cases. One, for example, is there's a working Catholic deacon called Patrick Jones out in Colorado Springs, and he's got the kind of memory deficit that some people might be familiar with from the movie Memento. He can't lay down new memories. If he had this conversation and then left the room and then came back in, then 10 minutes later he wouldn't know he'd had this conversation, except that he's become very adept at using lots of off-the-shelf software like Evernote and things like that in order to make ongoing trails of his daily evolving interactions and projects. And whenever he is in a social or clergy-type situation, he accesses these trails. Now, suppose we then think, okay, suppose somebody reached into his Evernote files and wiped them all. How should we think about that kind of interference? I think really we should think about that as an assault on Patrick Jones, the person. This isn't just a kind of an assault on his property. This is actually just like reaching into your head during the night and wiping out part of your memory. It will be the same, for example, people with some learning disabilities who might rely heavily on certain kinds of graphic visualizer to solve certain sorts of problem. Again, I think we shouldn't say of those people, they can't solve those problems. They need these graphic visualizers to do it. What we should say is, yeah, they can solve these problems, considered as extended minds.
Those are both examples of people with a deficit, as it were, so that they are using a kind of prosthetic memory. Couldn't somebody just reply, well, those are special cases. I mean, that's not what ordinary people normally do. It's just because they have exceptional circumstances that they have to rely on external stuff to a higher degree than most people do.
Yeah, I think it only looks that way to us just because there is a kind of neurotypical profile here that has a certain amount of leaning on external structure, bio-external structure. But if you imagine that, for example, we were somewhat different generally and that most people didn't need perhaps to use a yellow sticky note to remind them of a particular appointment the next day, then I think what you'd start to see is that, well, we lean on all these structures externally just as much as they do. It's just that there are typical profiles, and because we have these typical profiles, we kind of think of that as not leaning on these structures at all. But we do it just the same. So it's also true, maybe this is another strand of what you were getting at there, that there's no reason to think that our dovetailing with external structures is just sort of restorative. It's not just a matter of sort of offsetting a biological inadequacy. Rather, it's creating a new whole that may have new properties, some of which no human biology would ever support. So extended minds don't have to be big versions of biological minds. I think they can be something different.
I wasn't born digital, and I'm aware of a major transformation in my lifetime that was, by small increments, then a huge increment. Suddenly, in my pocket, I can carry a device which links me up with the rest of the world, it seems. I've got this vague sense it's changed my mind in some way. What would your account of the extended mind have to say about that transformation?
I think that really is happening, and it's interesting. I think that's also a reason why people do seem to me to be more interested in extended mind as time goes on. So, you know, in 1998, not everybody had a smartphone in their pocket, and nowadays everyone does, and we all have these new feelings. And I think what's really happening is that we're moving into a sort of metacognitive economy. What really counts is knowing how to get the right information at the right time. I think that's what we're really feeling, and this will surely make itself felt in education too. Instead of thinking that we have to get facts into the head, what you want to get into the head is the best way of organising the resources that will bring facts to the surface. And I think that is what we're feeling. We're moving towards a sort of distributed cognitive economy where what the bio bit does best is handle some of the meta-management.
We're getting to a stage where it's quite plausible to say that some computers are minds in some genuine sense. They're not just a bit like minds. They are thinking things. If you accept that, does it follow that computers themselves will have extended minds if they are really minds?
Yeah. I don't know if I quite buy the idea that we have thinking machines yet, but we're certainly getting closer and closer to it. And one recent development that I found particularly exciting from an extended mind perspective was the publication in Nature of a paper by Graves and colleagues from the Google's DeepMind group. And what they showed is, for the first time, they trained a deep neural network, one of these sort of the most powerful systems that are around at the moment, but they trained one so it will be able to profit from storing information outside of its dynamic sort of always changing memory store, storing information in a static way outside and accessing it in a sort of read-write-only sort of way. And so what this system was able to do was use tube maps. At least that was one of the things. So there were a few sort of benchmarks here, but one was a tube map thing. And so it could find its way around the London Underground, not by having all of that stuff in its neural network, but by having in its neural network ways of using the information that stayed out there in a tube map of the London Underground. Also, and maybe most interestingly, the system could then use other tube maps, say of the Paris Underground, and find its way around Paris, because many of the same sort of principles of external exploitation would apply. So here I think we're starting to see that our own tools are starting to use tools. These powerful computers are now using the kind of trick that human brains have always used, which is combining a sort of dynamic internal memory and processing store with something static and external, where that combination has hugely powerful kind of hybrid system properties. So I was particularly excited to see that even artificial neural networks are now becoming extended minds in their own right.
Andy Clark, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been great.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us. We now have two more podcasts. Nigel has one on philosophers and places they're associated with, www.philosophysites.com, and I have a podcast devoted specifically to moral and political philosophy, www.philosophy247.org.